outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gym.
Kyle, I finally got out of the house this weekend.
You did? Okay.
We had a short trip to Solvang here a month or two ago. But my son invited us to come to Denver and see him and his wife. And so we flew out on Thursday with my back and all and negotiating the trip. The hardest part, no kidding, was getting on the plane. Sarah carries a pretty good size carry-on that will not fit under the seat in front of her, which is where she would like to have it. So she's got to put it up on the overhead bin. And I, look like a total flake. Because my wife's managing this thing up by herself. She won't let me touch it because I can't do anything over 15 pounds. Not supposed to. And, oh, my gosh, it was so hard. I just kind of – I sat there with my head hung in shame that, man, I couldn't help my wife put her luggage in the overhead compartment.
I was wondering, did you get booed? Like, did people, like, give you, like, really agitated side eye? Or where were you feeling this social pressure from?
I just internally, probably no one said anything. I wasn't looking around the room to go, hey, look at me, man. I'm so cool. My wife,
I got my blinders on.
My wife is my slave. I tried to, you know, put my hand over there and look like I was lifting. It just felt weird. My gosh. That's what I like doing for Sarah when we travel, is helping her with stuff. And I couldn't help her with stuff.
Well, there is an option. There's an alternative to that. Sarah could lean down her carry-on to be 15 pounds, and then you could help her.
Yeah. I don't even know that I want to touch that.
If Sarah's anything like my wife's purse, her personal item, is 40 pounds. So.
Well, she has checked baggage under the plane. It's just... her carry-on is full of stuff. And so I didn't get a chance to lift it. And then we got back to Denver Airport yesterday to fly home and get through security. And there's this huge mass of people in this huge long line. We're going, what is going on? And then we hear the announcement, the trains taking people out to the gates are not operating.
Oh, my gosh.
And it just kept getting more and more packed. And they finally stopped the security lines. They wouldn't let more people in. Every place through security before you get on the trains was packed with people. And for whatever reason, no one decided that, you know, giving people a passenger walkway under there to the various terminals might have been a good idea in a state of emergency like this. But oh, no, we all had to wait till whatever operational error there was got fixed on the train. So.
Yeah, see, I mean, I've flown out of Denver countless times. That was our main, that still is our main hub airport closest to us. And yet, man, it can be an absolute mess. Like, I have never seen any of the other airports that I've ever flown out of fairly consistently have the issues that DIA has. For whatever reason, it is prone to epic messes for whatever reason.
I actually happen to like the airport. Overall, it works really well. I mean, getting in, the rental cars are all easy to get to. I mean, everything works really well there unless the trains aren't running.
But I've been there when their security was backed up and literally it was going out the door by ticketing. And there's been times where 1 minute it's 15 minutes to get through security and the next minute it's 4.5 hours. I mean,
I've never had that problem. So I don't know how to relate to that. But anyway, we had a great time with my son and his wife and got to watch the Masters with my boy, which is my favorite golf tournament of the year. And Rory McIlroy won. I don't usually root for foreigners on golf tournaments here in the States, but I did this time, and it's nice to see him finally win one.
Finally got the green jacket.
So, yes, through great adversity, my goodness. He would look like he was going to win it going away, and then he'd throw it all away and get behind and have to fight back and then hit in the trees. And anyway, it was fun. Had a good time.
He definitely likes drama in his gameplay.
And it was nice to share something like that with someone you care about who also cares about the thing. So Andy and I had a great time. Then we got up in the morning. It was 84 degrees on Saturday. And then we got up yesterday morning to go to the airport and there was snow on our rental car.
Welcome to a Mountain West spring.
How quickly things can change. My goodness, it's a drop of 50 degrees over a few hours.
Yeah, that sounds about right. We're currently enjoying, it's 81 degrees outside right now. And as I'm looking out my window, and we're forecasted for snow in 2 days. So wow.
We don't do that here in California.
Yeah, thankfully, California weather isn't as bipolar as a lot of the people that live there. So
for sure. For sure, that's true. I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And this is The God Journey. Glad you're here. Glad you're joining us today. Kyle, you got the best thing you heard this week?
I do. I was listening to a podcast just about your body and your body hijacking you.
Oh, we did a podcast kind of on this, didn't we?
We did. And I was listening to this podcast. I was like, man, I wish I would have heard this before we had that podcast, because there was a lot of just really good information in there. But one of the things that just really caught my attention was that emotions are actually a form of memory. And I've known that, but to hear it put so succinctly, and then they were talking about implicit memory. So those are the unconscious memories that we can't naturally draw from or bring up. Usually they're from earlier age, earlier life. And yet it talks about how those implicit memories, those unconscious memories, when they get activated, they create this emotional and physiological response. But the problem with them is that you don't know that it's a memory, right? When you're drawing on a conscious memory, you're thinking, oh, okay, yes, I have a conscious awareness. Here's this memory. This is where it's playing in, or I'm getting triggered by this. It's bringing up an event that I had with so-and-so back in the day, or whatever that looks like. And yet our implicit memories do not feel like a memory. It feels like it is the emotional response in the present moment in that situation, versus it being tied back to when that initial reaction occurred due to that emotion and connected to that type of memory. And so it was very interesting. It was a very intriguing podcast.
All righty. So there was no succinct line that gives the best thing I heard this week. It was the whole podcast.
It was a great podcast.
Sarah and I tried to listen to it because you sent me a link on the way back from the airport. We were driving back, and about 20 minutes into it, so Sarah said, can you turn this off? And I went, what? You don't? She said, that woman's voice is agitating me. So the podcast is actually stimulating the very thing in you that it's trying to talk about, not stimulating. So anyway, we didn't get to hear the end of it. Not yet.
Well, it's very good podcast. I wanted to do a little bit of research on the people, though, because, I mean, it was good information that was in it, but there are some things in there that kind of piqued my curiosity a little bit on, are these actually trained professionals or are these layperson, spiritual advisor type things? And I think there's a little bit of both going on. So that was intriguing.
But, okay. Yeah. Yeah, it was fascinating.
What about you?
Yeah, I had this was in a personal exchange with a friend. We were talking, remember last Friday, a week ago, a week ago, was the anniversary of my flying home, Sarah being gone, and how this opened a new chapter in our life. We were talking about that. And he wrote me this in a text. He said, this has been your story for the past 3 years. Redemption has always cost someone something. Hmm. And that phrase just got me thinking, because, and I don't want to say this starting out, when I talk about my pain dealing with this, I was also thinking about Sarah's pain. That Sarah, because whatever my pain was, it's minuscule compared to the pain my wife has suffered through the whole of her life that she's now finding a way to find healing in and find escape from. But that redemption has always cost somebody something really got me thinking. And when I thought about what Sarah, the price of pain Sarah has paid, it wasn't necessarily redemptive pain. It was kind of the opposite of that. It's the pain that someone else put on her for their amusement. Does that make sense? Where that got me going was to think about the difference between godliness and ungodliness. Godliness is willing to pay the price for someone else's redemption.
Okay.
And ungodliness is willing to exploit someone for my own amusement. And it's exactly the opposite. One takes pain on, the other puts pain on. Does that make sense?
Yeah. The other one actually inflicts pain versus being willing to shoulder or take away the pain.
Being redemptive in it. And one of the things that has spurred me on in my self-encouragement times, or maybe godly encouragement times, is that somebody did this to Sarah that hurt her very deeply. And if I get to be the person who helps walk her out of it, me and some other folks as well, but if I get to be part of that, man, that's just, that's a deep, incredible honor. To be able to help reverse in someone what someone else put on them. And I think about it because this is male and I'm male, that it really, some man really, really hurt her. Some men really hurt her. And now I get to stand with her to be part of that redemptive process. But it has been incredibly painful. Now, as I said, I want to reiterate this because my pain doesn't compare at all to Sarah's pain. Sarah's pain that she has endured is incredible. But that, just that thought, redemption always costs someone something. I don't know that it's true. I don't know that that's always a reality, but it certainly was true for God. It certainly is true in most relationships I've been in. To be the redemptive person in a story costs something. And if you're not willing to pay the cost, you tend to run from that opportunity to be redemptive in a story.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because we were talking today in class about the difference between our cognitive learning and our body's knowledge or our heart's knowledge, and how our brains can learn something fairly quickly, and yet our body has a lot slower learning capacity. So that idea of, okay, I understand this logically, I understand this in my head, but my body is telling me something completely different. It's still telling me that I am in threat. It's still telling.
And that goes to emotions too, right? People are
thinking,
not just physical. It's also like, you can know that you're loved by God. You can be theologically convinced that's true.
Yes.
And yet have these intense moments where it feels like God's against you and you're not loved and you're unworthy of love. And so Now, we always joke about that. It's proverbial in Christendom, between the heart and the head. My head knows, but my heart didn't get it, and you know, all that. So that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, and it launched into this conversation about being treated the way that we used to be. And so this idea of, okay, I've been healing, I've been growing in my understanding, I've been changing as a person, and yet I'm being treated by either my spouse or people around me that I love, like I'm the old man. And the process of also teaching them what it's like to be with somebody safe. Because I think about what you're talking about with walking with Sarah through that, right? Mm-hmm. And yet you're talking about a process that for a long time, very influential males in her life were the author of her pain. And so for her, as she's growing and as she's learning, are you finding yourself, like, are you recognizing the new Sarah? Are you recognizing those new changes? Are you able to see those and affirm those in her? And can she see those in herself, or does she continue to treat herself like she was the old version of herself? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's I'd say that's all very transitional. I think I do see the real Sarah and the Sarah that's changing.
Yeah.
And I think my responsibility is to make room for that. I've got to make room. When she changes, when something moves in her being, she becomes a different person.
Yeah.
And if I like the old, I'm going to say it in as crass way as possible, if I like the old subservient Sarah, then I don't like those changes. And I've met guys who just don't want that. They actually enjoy the trauma-caused responses of their partner. And as their partner begins to heal, they refuse to make room for that. And yeah, I do notice those when they happen in Sarah. I do notice the old, and I'm never sure in a situation we're going into which one's here for a bit.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair.
Is this which we call, you know, the child brain Sarah? Is this that one that was so? And that's not demeaning her, that's talking about that part of her that got froze up as a child, or is it adult brain Sarah who's got a little more freedom to navigate life? And yet learning to recognize that is part of this journey for both of us. It's not just Sarah's journey, it's ours. And I want to make every bit of room I can. And I feel like God's really asked me to do that, to make every bit of room I can for the new Sarah to emerge and to hold with compassion the Sarah that's still broken and still struggles with things that I would wish her to be past by now, but she's not. So being with her in both frameworks and learning to recognize that, that is part of my journey right now.
Yeah, it's interesting because I Jess and I were talking the other day just about marriage coaching and just dialoguing about that in relationships. And so many relationships I know, they end because one of the people in that couple is starting to heal. They're starting to get better. And either they feel like the other person is an anchor that's like holding them back or shaming, trying to get them back to that old person. Like you said, like, I liked that version of you worked a lot better than this new healing version of you. Right. And just the challenge that it is as a couple to work through that and walk alongside of that with one another. Right. Because that takes a toll on you just as much as it takes a toll on Sarah to be able to create and hold that space for the new Sarah to emerge. You have to be committed to, I want to explore who this new version of my wife is, even if it challenges me in some ways or challenges the way that we used to do relationship. I still want her to be the most whole version of herself. And I want to create space for that. And I want to learn what that is.
Yeah. And I'll give you an example of that, not necessarily from a trauma thing, but it could be religious trauma, but those people that grew up where the wives were subservient to the husband got his way about everything. Cause he is the quote unquote head of the home, air quotes all over the place here. And when the woman begins to discover the wife that, oh, I'm one of God's kids too. And I have insights and thoughts and things. And this whole idea of, I just have to do whatever my husband wants, or I don't respect him. And the husband is completely challenged by that. Why wouldn't he be? He's gotten everything he's wanted. We don't have fights because I'm the head. I get my way. And the woman quietly goes along. And now the woman starts to find her voice and starts to speak up and starts to say, no. And especially if it comes down to things like how we deal with the kids. And the husband got one way that's usually pretty autocratic and authoritative and demeaning to the child, and the wife more sensitive to what the child's heart and what's happening to the child's heart at this time, and tries to say, hey, let's not do it this way. Let's try another way with our kids. And he feels like that's complete disrespect because, oh, and I get that email quite often from people.
Yeah.
And it's hard for me. I just want to say to every husband, why wouldn't you want your wife to be the best version of herself? Why wouldn't you want your wife to find her voice? Is it easier to do that? No, because you've gotten away with everything for so long. Yeah. So yes, it does challenge the husband. Is he going to make room? And not just the husband, it can be cross genders depending on who's having the healing and who's gone through what. But who wouldn't want to create that space and risk the change, all of it? And I don't understand people that would prefer to live in the status quo of bondage instead of be a champion for their spouse's complete freedom.
And the hard part for me, I think, in this is that often the religious system of Christianity reinforces the man's role as the head of the, right? Like, absolutely. And so then not only is he getting challenged and being invited into a deeper experience of love and wholeheartedness, but if he races against that, if he resists that, he also has this the spiritual justification in his back pocket where he's like, oh, no, this is exactly how we're supposed to live it out. This is in alignment with the Bible. This is in alignment with scripture. Here's some really, really heavy chains to put back over the top of your body and to weigh you down with that have religious Christianity stamped on them. I mean, it's just, gosh.
And then you can accuse him, obviously, then often religious groups pull out the Jezebel tag or,
oh my gosh,
you're in rebellion against my authority. And
it's funny that you bring up the Jezebel thing, especially since we talked about spiritual warfare last week. I don't know how he got on my feed, but Mark Driscoll popped up on my Instagram.
Because you talk about Mars Hill all the time. That must be it.
I guess Instagram's listening.
Oh, and my gosh.
He pops up and he's literally talking about the Jezebel spirit and about the characteristics of the Jezebel spirit and how he is using that to inform husbands about women that they're considering marrying or people that they're married to. And if they're resisting, back to the kind of the demon hunting, if they're resisting the leadership and the authority of the men and resisting the structure, the God-ordained structure, then they are affirming this very, very strong Jezebel spirit in their lives. And oof.
He's still tooting that horn, huh?
He is.
After all he's gone through. Did you ever stop and sit back and look and say, maybe I'm missing something here? Not even a little bit.
No. He's still got a platform and people are still gung-ho about it. So,
Here's what I know. Every time my life has had to adjust to Sarah's healing, I've become a better version of Wayne. So I don't look at this as, oh, I'm just letting Sarah run riot now and Wayne's just her, you know, little sycophant, you know, willing to let do it, whatever. I become the best that Jesus wants me to be when I love Sarah well. And when it challenges me to change and to make room for something different and not be the one in control of what's going on, that's where I become, I think, freer myself. And I've come to really embrace that wholeheartedly. And I think underneath this sentence of redemption has always cost someone something. And the observation that evil always takes something from someone that they don't deserve. I've just explored this so much over this weekend when we were traveling about and doing stuff of how much evil takes, ungodliness takes and causes pain, and love offers. Love doesn't force. This is what, in trying to contrast these two with Jesus, if you're the one taking on someone else's pain as a part of redemptiveness, which is what love is, then love, this is where it's really affecting my relationship with God, then love can't force itself on someone. And love can't be taken, it has to be given. So I remember as a kid, I remember someone teaching a sermon from somewhere from the Old Testament about, according to the works of my hands commandest thou me. It was the old King Jimmy. But the whole gist of the sermon was, God's given us the right to command his power to do what we think is best to do, to see and be. And I grew up with that. Or the scripture, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence and the violent people and the violent take it by force, which is, again, this whole, man, we're going to take. And the transformation in my heart that has come just over learning to live loved, and that Matthew 6 about, what I want you to do is not be so preoccupied with getting that you can't respond to God's giving. Where love exists, where God loves Wayne perfectly, Wayne doesn't have to take anything from God. Wayne doesn't have to demand anything, to pray, to convince myself, to try and move that mountain over there. I mean, the whole idea of love is it cannot be forced. And so therefore, my relationship with God, I don't force it. I don't try to demand it. The best place I can be with God is in that posture of, how do I receive it? To be recipient of the life of God. And so what are you giving me today, God? What are you showing me today? I've been learning to live there already. And this little comment from my friend on a text thread has worked its way into that of going, no wonder. No wonder those really desperate, demanding God do something and pulling out all the scriptural quotes you can to get him. Why that's never worked is because love cannot be taken. Love has to be given. And the same way with people around us who try to manipulate us, often in the name of love. If you really loved me, you would do X, Y. And the reason that's such a disconnect is because love can't be forced and it can't be taken. Love's given. It's an offer. It's the freedom to love. And when you're free to love, as God hurt for us, as Jesus goes to the cross, because redemption costs somebody something, and he paid that cost for us. And then Paul talks about Colossians 2 about filling up in ourselves that which was lacking in the sufferings of Christ. And you gotta, I mean, the old Baptist theology was nothing incomplete about the suffering of Christ. I mean, he died for the sins of the whole world once for all time, the sacrifice, which all that's true. But what Paul was talking about, as we live out that with other people, the sufferings of the cross are being filled up in us as well. When I choose to take on pain rather than protect myself from pain by forcing my way on other people, that love is such a completely different way of living than anything we'd learn in the world, because it's not self-protective and it's not demanding. It's not exploitive. It's not worried about what I can get from the other. And even so much ministry, as I go to various websites and people send me to read something, you go to the website. And this, when you look at the website from the very beginning, this whole website is about how they can get my money extracted from me. They're trying to figure out, you know, they're trying to offer me good stuff. I'm not saying that, but then you get hit up with a donation plug, a get on my mailing list plug of, I will send you a free this if you do that. The whole idea is they're forcing their thing on me because of their needs. And they haven't learned love enough to realize when you live in the generosity of God's love, you don't have to exploit people. Mm. You just don't. So in situations I'm in, I'm looking at this going, am I the pain causer here?
Yeah.
Or am I the one taking on the pain of someone else because I want them to know redemption? Or because I want to contain this pain here instead of letting it go to someone else and hurt them? So I'm jumping in the way of pain, which is somewhat what the cross was doing.
Yeah.
Does this make sense? This is where
I
have so reveled in this weekend. I couldn't wait till we podcast because I don't want to explore this with Kyle, because I feel like it's made things very, very clear in terms of even simple choices I make, even waiting in line at an airport with a botched whatever. I can be a disgruntled, angry, stomping, and there were those kind of people around us
that kind of
passing on my suffering to other people, or I can remain kind and nice and talk to people, and even know how crazy this is that the trains don't work and there's no walking path. You can do that in a way that's not increasing pain.
Yeah. And yet, when you think about it, so thinking back too, like, love is a learned emotion, right? There's a memory that is attached to that. And that's why you see so many of these generational challenges with, like, either somebody being prone to getting into abusive relationships because their concept of love, what they know of love, when you say the word love, what activates in their memory is shame and manipulation. Or abuse, and that's what's activated. And so when you say love, that's how their body is translating it. That's how their memory, their subconscious is translating love. And that's why God's light is so, you know, talking about how those who live in darkness fear the light, right? Because it is unveiling that love. It's unveiling truth, which is going to transform. But it is uncomfortable. It is a challenging. It's not easy to have God untangle those skewed, distorted, terrible versions or memories of what his love, his life is. And so even when somebody says, yeah, I would, that's why, you know, being transformed by the renewing of your mind, but that moves more than just the mind. That's moving the heart and that's moving the soul to be in a place where I'm not taking from someone. Love is not a manipulation. Love is not a they're gaining from me, or the whole idea where this is an interesting one. So you're talking about love and it not taking, right? It being something that you give, that it's something that shielding other people with it. And yet how often is the word love used to manipulate and to take and to shame?
Oh, in religious settings all the time. And
yes,
if your definition of love has been set by something that's exploitive or manipulative, the challenge God has to work beyond that in our hearts, to show us what true love is. Because when you really try to care about people, we've talked about this before, but moving on to this neighborhood, and just Sarah and I are interested in loving people around us. And then they know I'm a Christian writer and they know I'm this. And I think particularly one couple in particular on our street, you kind of get the idea when we're near them that they're expecting us to drop the salvation hammer on the Roman road at some point.
Pull out your big bullhorn and start yelling at them.
And every time we're with them and just have fun with them and just react to them and learn their light and what's going on in their lives and listen, I know it's throwing them off balance just a little bit. Because the idea of Christian love, again, is, okay, you're at some point, you've got to drop a hammer on me, and you're going to kind of tell me I'm going to hell, and I need, and that's the evangelistic responsibility we have as God's followers. I think, boy, the idea that love cannot be forced, that when I try to give something to a recipient that's not ready for it, then it's not a gift. And it's not loving, and it's not kind. And so love is, and I like this, Toby and I were talking last week about one of the chapters in this book we're working on. And we really talk about how God's love distributes life, the fullness mm-hmm. of life to people. And so love and life are tied up together. As we were talking, I'm thinking, so really what it means for me to love someone today is not have this tender feeling towards them. Mm-hmm. It's really asking the question, how can I impart life to them today? Hmm. How can I impart something that seems like life to them? Not how do I give them a scripture and how I give them a, you know, some kind of bit of truth that they need to wrestle with, but what are they ready to receive? Hmm. And how am I a giver of love in the world, a giver of life? And to me, that gives such a concrete evidence to what it means to love the world today. Or love the next person whose path I cross. It's what are they ready to receive and what of life that God has given me? Because all life comes from the Father and the Son. So they've given life to me. What of that life can I give to someone today that works where they're open, where their heart's ready, where it's not the confrontation of some theological thing that I do in the name of love. Love cannot be forced. That's what I keep coming back to. You just can't force love. Love is a gift. You can't receive love when it's forced on you. You can't give love if you're forcing it on someone else. Love is really being in that place of receiving life and imparting life. And that makes it just so clear instead of it's just, oh, it's my good Uzi, I love you with the love of the Lord. It's no. Love is the impartation of life. Life received, life given.
What you're describing and as you're processing, even the example that you gave with the people in your neighborhood, is in the trauma world, that's called either a healing or a recalibrating experience. And that's when somebody responds in a different way than your implicit unconscious memories expect them to. So you're bracing for whatever, like, so for example, them bracing for the religious diatribe of how they need to be saved, right? They're experiencing you imparting life, joy, laughter, having fun with them. And that is challenging. That's recalibrating in their heart, in their body, in their, at their subconscious level of they're not responding the way that I expected them to.
Yep.
This is actually life that I'm experiencing from them. And that's challenging those previous memories and recalibrating those memories to have a more healed perspective.
That's cool. We got to be part of that last week. We in a business, Sarah and I were at a business meeting with someone. And we could tell as we were talking, they had some connection to the shack. They liked it. And they found out I was connected to it. And we were talking, there's real life sharing going on.
Yeah.
And then he asked, you know, what church we go to. And I was, we didn't really do that in that way. We find a different way to share the life of the body of Christ together. And we talked about the relationships and whatever connections we have. And so later I just kind of asked him, I said, are you part of a fellowship somewhere? Because I found out he's my neighbor. He lives like four blocks over southwest of me. And so he lives very close, even though we were meeting in a different town. We weren't even in our same town. And I said, so is there part of something that you're part of spiritually like that? And he says, you could tell he hesitated. And then he says, well, I'm Church of Latter-day Saints. And you could tell it was awkward because what he was afraid of was we were having this life sharing and we were enjoying each other. And now he's going to tell me he's Mormon and I'm going to treat him differently as a pariah. Yeah. And I didn't. I just kept going. I said, oh, my goodness, we were at a luau at the fellowship there. He goes, what? I said, yeah, we were at a luau last spring or last fall. And he goes, I met you. I came to the table and we talked. I said, I saw you look familiar this whole time. I remember it. And we kept sharing life. We just kept enjoying it. And we didn't get into he didn't try to convert me. I didn't try and deconvert him. It's just because we'll have further contacts with him up the road. So it's so much more fun being in the place of to love someone and impart life than to confront people and get them to see and believe what I see and believe. And he was expecting the other. You could tell he was hesitant to tell me what he was connected to, because I would imagine he would have thought from most of what he's experienced that that would end our relationship. And
Right. And that's, man, talk about good work, right? The privilege of being able to be a part of that as we're allowing that healing, that rewriting to be taking place in our lives, that's that impartation of life. That is good news, right?
Yes, it is.
Like that's the good news. Like that's something people could actually get excited about hearing versus, oh boy, here comes the bullhorn or here comes the club that they're going to beat me into submission with.
Yeah. Here's the time to repent and get my life straight or I'm going to burn in hell forever. And I was reading a book by someone the other day, actually on the flight back from Denver. And they said, do you notice in the book of Acts, and Sarah and I are just finishing up the book of Acts. We've been reading through it together. Do you notice the disciples and their preaching to the people never invoke hell? I had never noticed that before. And I remember hearing it going, now that's shocking. If that's true, that's shocking. Because we can't hardly imagine. These were the evangelists of the day. These were the most effective evangelists we ever had. They never once mentioned hell. They were inviting people into the life of Jesus, into seasons of refreshing, into being transformed by this God who loved us and we've been estranged from our whole lives. And it's all that message. And I'm going, boy, did we really get it wrong? Did our whole Christian arguing for apologetics, condemning people until they jump through our hoops, hoping to instill fear in them so that they'll respond to the God in us, all work in the opposite direction from what love does, which love doesn't force itself. It just makes itself available and provides a way for people to embrace it without feeling manipulated and exploited. And I think that's why a whole lot of people, when you talk about our responsibility for evangelism, have to choke down their yuck meters because it feels like I've got to go out there and manipulate people in a way that I wouldn't want to be manipulated if I were them.
Yes.
And that's godly. The whole godly thing of I'm not going down that road. I'm going to love people. And when they're hungry enough to ask about what's true, I'm going to share what's true in the best way I can to just open their heart, not provide an exit ramp. And I think this whole distinction between redemption has always cost someone something. And the giving of life is willing to take on that pain for others because Jesus took on that pain for me.
Yeah.
And now I get to fill up in my own being that which is lacking in the sufferings of Christ for the people I know and love and live near and are a part of. This has been so much fun to be able to sit there and go, okay, this is kind of Wayne protecting himself from pain. So that's probably not the way I want to go.
Yeah.
And this is, it might be more painful, but it might be a gift of life to someone. And that's a whole lot more fun to go down that road. That sound like an ending?
It sounded like a very good ending. That was an excellent, I was like, okay, mic drop, I'm out.
I can see that, which we can do a short podcast. It won't hurt anybody.
I really like, I love that statement. And just for me, that now it's got my brain really turning. Because when I think about what is our original memory of love, when we're told, especially as an early childhood, I love you, right? And yet then there's these behaviors that we're experiencing or these things that we're experiencing. And it's like, man, it just, to me, it circles back to how freaking awesome God is at what he does. Yes. Because to untangle that, to have the skill and the intentionality and the patience to untangle that in the hearts and lives of billions of people is mind-blowing to me.
That yes. is like, jeez.
And even most of us had that thing said to us when we were back in the generation where we were spanked. This hurts me more than it's hurting you. And we went, bull. When I'm on the business end of that switch cut from that eucalyptus tree, I'm not believing. It's just love. I only do this because I love you. And how distorted we get that. Even the Hebrews 12 thing about God punishing and discipline. We use the word punishment, but the word is discipline. Yeah. It's training. It's very different from the violent, I'm going to make your life worse if you don't do what I want, which is the opposite of redemption. Mm-hmm. Redemption is, no, I'll take that pain over here, hoping you'll open up your heart and mind to the kind of renewal and wisdom and light that will allow you to walk in the light as he is in the light. It's just, to me, this, again, this comes up a lot with my conversation with Toby, because this is the justice of God. The justice of God is not who deserves the pain. The justice of God is, I'll take on the pain so that I can gift you healing. And now you're ready to come. Gosh, whether it's a Mormon businessman or my wife being free of trauma, my job today is, how do I take on the pain that will bring life to others? And it's not masochistic. It's not just, I'm going to be doing the most painful thing I can think of today. It's really, because we don't make those choices. I think the choice we do make is not to be so afraid of pain that we jump out of a circumstance that we could be redemptive in if we weren't being self-protective. Now, I say that realizing Sarah right now does need to be self-protective where she is in her journey. So if that's where you are, don't try to be here. Don't try to be where you're not. Until God's given you that life, you cannot give it. You don't have to volunteer for someone else's pain. It might be time in your life to be self-protective. So I'm not saying everybody should follow this. But when you find enough freedom that you don't need to be self-protective, then don't exit circumstances just because they grow difficult. Because you might be the one on whom redemption hangs in that circumstance.
I think for me, like, I have felt like that has ebbed and flowed. Like, there have been times where I felt like, yeah, I can really take this on for somebody, or I can walk through this with somebody, or I can shoulder that. And other times where it's like, nope, I don't have the capacity right now. And I need to honor that too. Like, this is more of a time for me to lean into the self-protection, God continuing to do work in my life, healing in my end. And that literally, I love that we brought this up, because the thing that I wrote down was, how do you protect yourself from becoming a martyr? Because I think so often there's that tendency, especially that's where the backdoor distortion of it through Christendom is, okay, you need to martyr yourself for the sake of others. And then that basically it's, no, you need to allow yourself to be abused so that I can continue to use you for the sake of my own personal gain, so that I can continue to move my agenda, platform, message forward. And that's yuck.
And when you realize God isn't like that, and if you're part of a redemptive process with other people and you're experiencing pain, there's a joy in that pain.
Yeah.
The joy set before, as you said, the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame. Inside, what we're talking about when it's real, it's not, okay, I'm going to go in there and get beat up all over again. There's a joy in being the lover in the room. There's a joy in having space in your heart to make room for the pain of another, for their hope of life and redemption. And if we can pay that, if we can open our lives to that, and if we're not ready for that yet, I like that we're talking about this too. I think one of the best podcasts Brad and I ever did back in the day was learning to live inside your own freedom. And that's all part of this whole journey of maturity and whatever. I've got to realize where I'm at today. And can I get involved in that today? I can't. I'm going to get swallowed. And Peter got swallowed that night in Jesus's pain because he wasn't ready to stand with his friend. He got swallowed by it. So when we realize that I have certain freedoms, or I don't have freedom there yet, so the I need to be self-protective there. Over here, I don't need to be, because I want to be a giver of life. And that's the point. It's not about pain. It's about the giving of life, that pain may be part of the process, but it's not pain for pain's sake, ever.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.